Good morning, everybody. My name is Jim Hardesty. I have the privilege of serving as the presiding judge of this panel of the Nevada Supreme Court. I would like to express my sincere appreciation on behalf of myself and my colleagues on the panel to your principal, Joshua Rosenblum, and to the coordinating teachers for this program, Kathy Morgan and Shelley Williamson. We are very grateful to you to let us come here and make a presentation and participate in actual oral arguments in very real cases, as you'll hear shortly. So thank you all very much. I'd like to ask my colleagues to introduce themselves briefly, and then we'll get into the cases, and I'll describe how we like to approach what we're doing and how we handle these what we call road shows, so to speak, in high schools. I'll ask Justice Stiglitz to first introduce herself, and then we'll have Justice Perry-Gary introduce himself.
Good morning. My name is Lydia Stiglitz. I'm the newest member of the Nevada Supreme Court. About 2 or 3 months ago, I was sitting on the trial bench in Washoe County. So hearing cases much like at least one of the ones that you're going to hear about today. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. After high school, I went to UC Berkeley and did my undergraduate. I went to law school at Hastings College of the Law, which is in San Francisco. And then came to Nevada. I was a public defender. I also did private practice, civil and criminal litigation. And I feel very fortunate to be here today with you.
And Justice Perry-Gary?
I'm Ron Perry-Gary, and Justice Hardesty and I were elected at the same time. Don't know how many years ago, but we're getting a little long in the tooth. How long has it been, Jim?
12 years.
12 years. Yeah. And we just got elected to our third term. And so we're happy about that. My background, after high school, I did my undergraduate in San Diego and ended up with my law degree from University of San Diego. And then directly out of law school, I went back to Washington, D.C. to clerk for then-Senator Paul Axel, who was one of the great senators. I took the bar back there and became a member of Pennsylvania and Washington, and it just so happened his counsel for Senate Judiciary Committee, one of the subcommittees, left, and so he asked me if I wanted that position. Of course, I took it, and it was a great opportunity because I was so young to have that kind of experience, and it was a great experience. After that, I went back to Las Vegas, where my dad had practice, and started practicing with him. He had a civil practice, did defense litigation, toxic chemical litigation, and so it was a varied civil practice. And next thing I knew, he kind of left me with that practice. He took the bench in the 5th Judicial District. So. I essentially ended up with that practice. I was elected to the municipal court because I just kind of liked the process, and I tried to get one of my associates to run so we could have a little fun with the campaign, and he said, no, why don't you run? So I did, and I won, and then all of a sudden I thought, oh, I gotta give up my practice. And so I did. My associates took it over, and I served on the municipal court bench for about 9 years, and then I was appointed to the district court bench in 1999 and served on the district court bench, the trial court bench, for I think 6 years. And then in 2004, Justice Hardesty and I, as I said, ran for the Supreme Court in contested elections. And won. It was a statewide race, and you know, it was a great experience, I thought.
Well, the election wasn't, but the beat on the court is. So let me outline what we do. The Supreme Court, starting about probably 10 years ago, has been conducting oral arguments in very real cases in high schools throughout the state. We've probably been in 35 to 40 high schools around the state of Nevada. And you will hear arguments today in two very serious cases. These cases were picked by the panel to be argued today in this high school for specific reasons. And I'll discuss some of those reasons after we've heard argument in the case. I'm going to ask Mr. Leonard, on behalf of the appellant, to provide you with a description of the facts of the case from his perspective, and to introduce the colleagues that are sitting with him. And then I'll ask the respondent's counsel to provide any additional information he'd like to share about the facts of the case, and then we'll begin argument. In every case in front of the Nevada Supreme Court except death penalty cases, the argument is limited to a half an hour. Each side gets 15 minutes. The appellant, who has the burden on appeal, gets to reserve time and come back and rebut, but that comes out of their 15-minute allotment. Afterwards, I'm going to ask counsel to provide you with a little bit of background concerning their professional background as lawyers. I'm going to also invite you to ask questions of them and us. We cannot discuss the case, so I'll ask you not to ask questions about the case, but you can ask questions about the court and the court process. So with that, we'll spend just a couple of minutes asking appellant and respondent to describe the facts of their case, and then we'll get into the argument. So, Mr. Leonard, would you like to begin?
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Kirk Lampard. I'm an attorney in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a regional firm called Johnson & Hyatt Barber & Shrek. With me here today is one of my associates, Emily Ellis. Also with me is Mackenzie Warren. She's one of our law clerks. You may recognize Ms. Warren. She used to be on the TV here as an anchor of one of the local news broadcasts until she found religion. In any event, one of the privileges, it's a privilege to practice law, and one of the responsibilities that goes with this privilege is being willing to take a pro bono case. My firm was appointed by Chief Judge Betsy Gonzalez to represent the petitioner in this case. We are a pro bono representation. He cannot afford representation. So we volunteer our services to assist him with this court. The case before you today, as you're going to hear, is a very interesting and fascinating situation. I understand you've all read the news. It's an issue concerning parole. Michael Anselmo was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for a particularly heinous crime that was made with no ranking sentence. He was pardoned by the Pardons Board in 2005. The issue before the court today will be whether he can be forced to remain in prison due to the severity of the crime, or must the parole board also consider his chances of recidivism, his chances to re-enter society as a reasonably productive citizen? Our position is, on behalf of the appellant, those factors must be considered. To date, those factors have not been considered in considering Mr. Anselmo's request for parole. It's our position, and we will hear this in argument today before the court, it's our position that the parole board's refusal to consider these factors is tantamount to ignoring the decision of the Pardons Board. It is a discrete issue because in Nevada, like many states, there is not a right to parole. It is a privilege. And so you have these competing interests when you hear the arguments of that. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Carter.
My name is Jeffrey Connor. I'm an assistant solicitor general with the Nevada Attorney General's Office. I think Mr. Lenhart has quite aptly described the facts in this case, and you'll hear my point of view, that the parole board has appropriately exercised the discretion that has been granted to it by the Nevada legislature, and that it acted appropriately in denying Mr. Anselmo's request for parole. And you know, that will be the basis of my argument. So, go from there.
All right, let's get started with the arguments then. Mr. Leonard, or the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of the petitioner appellant, we would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I realize that inevitably I'll spill over, and I would also like permission from Ms. Ellis to do the rebuttal, if that's
yes.
appropriate with the court.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel for the state, people in the audience. You know, at the risk of burning a little bit of my time, I really have to comment on the venue here today. I practiced law for 41 years in this jurisdiction. I've appeared in the old Supreme Court building, the new Supreme Court building. I've appeared in the RJC in that courtroom. I've appeared at the North Las Vegas Commission Chambers. I appeared at that storefront that you had temporarily on Carson Avenue. And I've appeared at the UNLV Law School. But in all honesty, this is by far and away the most intimidating venue I've ever been in. This is one tough jury. That said, to the business at hand. Today I appear on behalf of the petitioner, Michael Anselmo. He was convicted of murder in 1972 at the age, I believe, of 19. He has served 45 years in the Nevada State Prison. He's presently housed at the Northern Nevada Correctional Center. He may be one of the two or three longest serving inmates in the prison system, a dubious distinction at best. In accepting the representation of Mr. Anselmo, we were tasked with answering this question as posed by this court. And I'm going to paraphrase because to make it easier for the audience. To provide briefing and or argument on the issue of whether the district court, in this case Judge Russell, erred in dismissing appellant's, Mr. Anselmo's, petition for failure to state a cognizable claim in light of the California Supreme Court's decision in In re Lawrence. The fact I am standing here today, I think, clearly indicates what I feel the answer should be. This court should clearly follow the dictates of the Lawrence decision. And if you follow the dictates of the Lawrence decision, you are no more than following the statutory requirements under Nevada law. So before I really go into detail as to why this court should follow Lawrence, I think I've got to put this case in its proper context. And that means I have to go through briefly the history of Mr. Anselmo, both in the prison system, before the Pardons Board, and before the Parole Board. What I am not doing in this case, so we are clear, I am not downplaying in any way the severity of the offense committed by Michael Anselmo. Nor am I asking this court to act as a super parole board. I'm not asking this court to grant parole today. I'm asking this court to give instructions. In May 1972, as far as the history, as I said, Mr. Anselmo was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. As the court's aware from our briefing, on two separate occasions in the mid-1970s, Mr. Anselmo attempted escapes. On top of his sentence of life without the possibility of parole, he was sentenced to two consecutive 10-year sentences for these attempted escapes. So by the mid-1970s, Michael Anselmo had two choices because he's facing life without the possibility of parole. He's never getting out of prison. He has two choices. Go into the prison system, be a thug, like many people in the system, join a gang, just basically exist. Or do something to improve himself. And as Ms. Ellis accurately pointed out in our briefing, he took step number two. He engaged in a process of redemption, rehabilitation, and education, with no hope of being released. And what he did was interesting. He got his Bachelor of Arts degree. He got two associate degrees. He received training in CPR. He did a number of things that weren't required or necessary to try to improve himself. And you know what? This activity was not ignored by the Pardons Board. It came to the attention of the Pardons Board in 2005. And who makes up the pardons board? It's the governor, the secretary of state, and the justices of the Supreme Court. And I believe in the case of his pardons board, it was six justices, not seven at the time. The Board of Pardons considered Mr. Anselmo's history. They considered his crime, and they determined that his sentence should be commuted to 5 to life, which means he would be eligible for consideration by the State Board of Parole. Now, it's interesting. One of the members of that pardons board was the Honorable Robert Rose. Robert Rose was the DA who prosecuted Michael Anselmo 33 years before. He felt it was appropriate for this man to have a chance for parole. He had paid his dues to society. He was eligible for parole starting in 2006. The actions before the parole board is what brings me before this court today. Starting in 2006, on four separate occasions, Michael Anselmo appeared before the parole board. Each time his parole was denied, for a discrete reason, the severity of the offense. Due to the nature of the offense, he was being denied parole. Severity of the offense and the fact that the type of offense gradually became worse in his criminal history.
Sir, can you speak up just a little bit? I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Normally, that's not normally a problem I have, so. Is that better?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Sorry, Judge.
No.
Anyway, he's before the board. They made four denials. What do they not find in the case of Mr. Anselmo? They do not find that he is a threat to society, nor do they find that he is likely to commit another felony if he's released. In other words, they do not find that he's a good, significant chance of being a recidivist. That is an important fact for when you consider the N. Ray Lawrence factors that we're asking the court to follow.
Let me ask you this. Unlike California, parole in Nevada is an act of grace, and you have no liberty interest in the grant of parole. And our statutes specifically indicate that the severity of the crime is to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
And why isn't this better left for the legislature to address rather than this court? If the legislature wanted to create the laws that the severity of the crime shouldn't be considered, that's their prerogative.
I've been waiting for that question and anticipating it. The legislature has addressed that issue in NRS 213-1099, where the legislature states the board may release on parole a prisoner who otherwise eligible for parole person to in the statutory site. In determining whether to release a prisoner on parole, the board shall consider. And then they go on the reasonable probability the prisoner will live and remain at liberty without violating the law, whether the release is incompatible with the welfare of society, and the seriousness of the offense. So the legislature has mandated that the chances of recidivism be something to be considered by the board. And that's the problem in this case, because the board specifically has determined that Mr. Anselmo is a low risk of recidivism. They are basing the decision on the severity of the crime alone, and therefore ignoring the very dictates of Section 1099. And I'll remind the court, also, Section 10885 of Chapter 213, which subsection 2, which makes the same provisions. You consider the severity of the crime, the criminal history, previous parole violations, then the potential threat to society, as well as the length of his or her incarceration. The problem with the board's action here, and this is why I think the court framed the question to be answered by me as representative of the petitioner, is that part of the legislation is being ignored by the parole board. In determining that the severity of the offense keeps Mr. Anselmo in prison, they are not considering the other factors
but
under
sir,
the statute.
In making the finding that he was unlikely to reoffend, doesn't that in fact to show that they did consider that factor, but perhaps
see,
they weighed the other factors more heavily against him?
You can make that argument. What I'm saying is, and again, following the factors as outlined in the Lawrence decision, if you determine that you're going to keep the man in prison for the severity of the offense, you've got to specifically find that he has had a significant chance of being a recidivist. He has a significant chance of committing another offense if he goes back out. He has a significant chance of a threat to society as a whole. That's the step that's not being taken here. All the board is doing is saying he's a low risk, the crime is significant, therefore he remains in prison. What the board is, in essence, doing is circumventing the pardons board.
The board did one other thing, I believe, that I want to ask you about, and I'm going to ask counsel for the state to address. In the four times that they turned him down, three of those times they indicated that he continued to be a moderate risk, at least moderate or low moderate, and then they determined that he was a low risk. But on the last occasion that is of interest to me, they not only referred to the seriousness of the offense that brought him into prison in the first place, but they also said that he is now not only a low risk, but he is a risk to society. He has a future risk of offending. Would you comment about that? And should we expect the board to have evidence that supports such a finding?
Well, that was where I was going. And that's where I think the question posed by the court in the citation in Ray Lawrence is important. If you're going to base the denial of parole on the severity of the offense, you need to make a specific finding, and I suggest under the statute that is warranted, a specific finding that Mr. Anselmo is a risk to commit another crime, is a risk or a threat to society, and you have to back it up with facts, not just the generic, we find. It's got to be, we find because. Otherwise, the consideration for parole that is mandated by our statute under Chapter 213, the consideration, Justice Hart-Perigary, not mandating parole, mandating consideration for parole. The consideration for parole is being denied because the board is not saying why he's being denied parole. All they're basically saying is his crime is severe, he's a low risk or whatever, we're not going to explain anything else. I'm asking this court to do nothing else but remand this matter to Judge Russell for remand of the parole board with instructions that if you're going to base the denial of Mr. Anselmo's parole on the severity of the offense, define what it is that makes him a risk to society and a threat for recidivism. That's all I'm asking, nothing more. And I think that, under our statutory scheme, is perfectly appropriate.
So your position is that anyone who commits a murder, the severity of the offense would always keep them in prison. They could never get out, even if they are eligible and have served 45 years.
Certainly that's the extreme that could happen here. And I think that's the extreme that's happened in the case of Mr. Anselmo. All I'm asking, as the counsel for the petitioner is, compel the board to state the reason, beside the severity of the offense, that he's being maintained in prison.
Well, and I'm not sure in practice that's what happens. Because Justice Hardesty just indicated the fact that every murderer would be denied parole. In practice, that doesn't happen.
And I think that's true.
And the other issue is, you know, I was a sentencing judge, and if I have all the facts displayed before me during a trial, I took my sentencing very seriously. And if I said life without, that's exactly what I meant. And coming before the parole board was an act of grace for the parole board to give him life with the possibility of parole, and running one of the two consecutive sentences concurrent.
As you know, I was a public defender for a number of years, so I've certainly been on the other end of the sentencing spectrum. I don't think I had a sentencing in front of you at that time. I think I was already in private practice. But sentencing is a serious step. But what I'm getting at here, for purposes of our parole statute and what we're asking the board to do, parole is an act of grace. But once that act of grace is to be considered, once you opt for board consideration, minimum due process requires certain steps be taken. I'm suggesting under the In re Lawrence factors, minimum due process requires, if he's going to be denied parole and the severity of the crime, set out why the board thinks he's going to be a recidivist, why the board thinks he's a threat to others.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Have I blown through 15 minutes?
So yes, yeah. if the board were to come back, if it were to go back and they say we find he's a low risk, he's not going to recidivate, but we think the crime is so severe, we're not ready to let him go.
I don't think there's anything I can do. Because the board has given the consideration that I've asked for.
Thank you.
Thank you. We still get a minute in rebuttal. Or?
I'll grant you 3 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Ellis, that is. And Mr. Connor, you'll have 18 minutes.
Thank you, Judge.
Please, the court, Jeffrey Connor, on behalf of the respondents. I'd like to spend my time this morning really discussing 2 points with the court in a way that I hope will break this down in a way and using terms that are things that the audience are using in their classes and concepts that they understand from being in government class, and developing a distinction between Nevada law in California law, and also Nevada law and South Carolina law, in the way that the respondent has relied upon the cases from South Carolina and California in his briefing. This case is, I think, a great case to be discussing in front of the courts because it involves very clearly an issue of separation of powers and has a taste of federalism to it as well. And where the federalism issue comes from is that if we start with Greenholz versus inmates of the Nebraska Penal and Correctional Complex. In that case, the Supreme Court of the United States recognized that not all executive decision-making is subject to the protections of the Due Process Clause, and particularly in the area of parole release. They recognized that in order to trigger the protections of the Due Process Clause, you have to have a legally cognizable right that triggers the protections of, you know, being not allowing the state to deprive you of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So you either have to have a liberty interest at stake or a property right. And in Greenholz, the Supreme Court of the United States recognized that there is not a cognizable constitutional or otherwise inherent right to a conditional release prior to the expiration of a valid sentence. That's what we're talking about here with parole, is that parole is the opportunity to be conditionally released from incarceration while you are still subject to a valid judgment of conviction that requires you to serve a longer amount of time than you have. And so there the Supreme Court recognized that the federal Constitution does not require that. But of course we know that states are allowed to provide people with more protections than that are required by the federal Constitution. And so states have the option of providing for the opportunity of parole release. And in Greenholz, the court made clear that just the mere opportunity for release does not create an expectation of release. It is just a mere hope that they'll receive the benefit of early release. But states are permitted to phrase their statutory framework governing parole release in a way that does create an expectation of release. And that is then what gives rise to the protections of the Due Process Clause. And therein lies the distinction between California and Nevada. California in Section 3041 of the California Penal Code recognizes that the California Parole Board shall set a date for release unless the parole board makes specific findings about the gravity of the offense, establishing that the applicant continues to remain a danger to the public. Nevada is very different. Nevada says in NRS 213.1099 that the parole board may release somebody. And so,
but the statute is confusing because it also uses shall in assessing factors in making the discretionary decision.
So that is very true, Your Honor. But I would also, at that point, turn to Nevada Revised Statute 213.10885, which acknowledges that there are very specific record-keeping requirements placed on the parole board, and there are very specific reporting requirements for the parole board to the legislature. And among those reporting requirements is that the parole board is required to report to the parole board on any denials of parole that have deviated from the standards that the parole board is supposed to follow in granting parole. So that statute recognizes that the parole board has been granted extreme discretion in this area, that they are permitted to deviate from these standards in any case. But more importantly, Your Honor, the idea that there is an interest in release. In Greenholz, when the Supreme Court said there is no right to release or early release, the reason they said that is because when you have been convicted of a crime that carries a period of incarceration as your punishment for that crime, you've received all the due process that you're entitled to for the deprival of your liberty all the way up to the maximum term of that sentence. So unless the states
engage in a statutory construct that set out a series of factors that the board is supposed to consider, are we to simply ignore that when the board disregards those factors? And put this in context in your argument. My understanding is that in the fourth effort Mr. Anselmo made to seek parole, the board responded by identifying first he was a low risk, but then also indicating that the reason they were retaining him or not granting parole was because of the severity of the crime and because they had identified him as a potential threat to society. As to that final point, what was the basis for that? There was no change in the way he had performed in prison for the previous 2 years, in fact, the previous 10 years. So what was the basis for the board's determination that they thought, in addition to his severity of crime, they thought he would become a threat to society? And to that extent, if there is an absence of factual basis, should we grant relief to Mr. Anselmo for the limited purpose of requiring the board to explain that?
The first answer to that, Your Honor, is no. Because the legislature has specifically recognized, and in NRS 213.10705,
am I right on the facts that was one of the reasons they denied?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
But when we look to NRS 213.10705, that statute makes a very specific legislative declaration that there is the creation of factors for considering parole release is not a basis for creating a cause of action against the state or any of its sub-entities, okay? And so there's that aspect of it. The second point is that unless there's a liberty interest in release, he's received all the due process that he's entitled to. For he has a valid life sentence. That means in the state of Nevada, because he has no liberty interest in parole release, that's all that has to be established for him. For the parole
is he enforcing his liberty interest, or is he enforcing a right under the statute that requires the board to follow a prescribed factor?
And my answer to that, Your Honor, is that just the nature of the offense alone can be a basis to deny parole in Nevada. And under N. Ray Lawrence in California, it cannot. Because in California, the court found that you have to make a causal connection between the nature of the offense and the risk of danger to the public because that's the way that California's statute is worded. Nevada's determination for release does not say that. It says may release.
Mr. Connor, you agree that they shall consider the factors, correct? You agree. That's what the statute requires.
I agree that they're supposed to consider factors, but the statute also makes clear, and the regulatory framework that's in place, too, also recognizes that the parole board, in any case, is allowed to deviate from those standards.
Absolutely, but they shall consider them, because your counsel's only asking to go back so that they shall consider the factors as the statute requires. They may still come out in the same way.
And
isn't there a value on due process, right?
I think they have considered those factors, but the point is that...
What in the record supported the board's conclusion that he would be a risk to society if he was released?
Your Honor, I think, one, my answer to that is that the very nature of the crime that he committed, I'd like to think that somebody who has committed a murder is probably more likely to commit a murder or some lesser crime again when they're released from prison. They've demonstrated that they're capable of committing the most egregious crime there is. And in this case, it was particularly egregious. You know, Mr. Anselmo may have been a young man at the time of his offense, but he killed the 22-year-old woman by stabbing her multiple times. So it's a very egregious, very serious crime. And so that alone, so one, I think the nature of the offense alone also supports the point that he continues to always be a danger to the public. But inherently, regardless of whether the nature of the offense actually supports that or not, in Nevada, the nature of the offense alone is a basis for denial of parole, and for that reason alone, this court should affirm the district court's judgment, because when we get into this stuff, the legislature very clearly did not intend for these things to be subject to judicial review. They've allowed the parole board to deviate from the standards that they're supposed to consider. They have very specific reporting requirements that the parole board is supposed to report to the legislature on every legislative session. So the legislature is keeping very close tabs on the parole board and its exercise of discretion. And if there was ever any question that the parole board was exercising its discretion in a way that was arbitrary and capricious, the legislature knows exactly how to take that discretion away from the parole board and give this court the opportunity to exercise individualized judicial review in every case.
Well, in the sense that assessing whether or not there would be a risk to the public is one of the considerations, and for us to tack on to that the requirement that they make specific findings, doesn't that make essentially every determination reviewable by us?
Yes. I mean, I think that opens the door to any time somebody's before the parole board for them to file a habeas, whatever method they choose. I don't think I agree with the positions that's been taken in the briefing that a habeas petition is not the appropriate vehicle for raising this issue. But once this court imposes
the requirements... Do you agree that if they had filed a judicial review petition under Rosencrantz, it would have been reviewable?
Could you repeat your question, Your Honor?
Do you agree that if this had been a petition for judicial review under Rosencrantz, that it would have been reviewable?
No, I do not, Your Honor. I think...
Why not?
In re Rosencrantz is specifically focused on the fact that California law creates a due process liberty interest in release. But this court in Moreau and very many times before that has found that there is no interest in release. And in Moreau, this court specifically found that because there's no interest in release, the due process clause does not provide any protection during a parole hearing. And that's specifically where the sum evidence standard in In re Rosencrantz comes from. They didn't reach the idea that there has to be some evidence to support the board's determination until they first recognized that there was an existing due process liberty interest that was created by in release that was created by California's parole system. Now, quickly,
and Nevada's been fairly consistent in emphasizing that on a number of occasions.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if I could turn quickly also, there's a very important distinction with the South Carolina cases that the petitioner turns to. He looks to South Carolina, where South Carolina has recognized that there is a liberty interest in parole eligibility. And in the Cooper case that they turn to and rely on very heavily, there's a specific point in that case that distinguishes Nevada from South Carolina. There, the South Carolina court at page 499 said, if the parole board deviates from or renders its decision without consideration of appropriate criteria, we believe it essentially abrogates an inmate's right to parole eligibility and thus infringes on a state-created liberty interest. Undoubtedly, the parole board is the sole authority with respect to decisions regarding the grant or denial of parole. However, the legislature created this board to operate within certain parameters. We don't believe the legislature established the board and intended for it to render decisions without any means of accountability. Nevada's statute addresses that specific point. The parole board is permitted to deviate from its standards in any case, and it's required to report on that to the legislature. And if the legislature at any point is concerned that the parole board is abusing that discretion by acting in an arbitrary and capricious manner, the legislature can clearly take that discretion away from the parole board at any time.
Again, give me an example. I'm trying to put this in context where the legislature would find that they acted arbitrarily and capriciously because they don't have to make findings to support any of their determinations.
It's hard for me to think of something, actually, Your Honor. One thing that potentially comes to mind, but I don't know that it would even need to trigger this court's ability to review under the due process clause, is if perhaps the parole board denied somebody parole based on their race. Now, I think that would also create a concern under the equal protection clause, so we wouldn't really need to deal with whether or not there's a due process liberty interest under the statute. But I think that's a circumstance where very clearly the parole board would be acting in a manner that's arbitrary and capricious.
If Mr. Anselmo were black, would he have a remedy?
If he could establish that the basis for the denial was his race and that the state couldn't meet the strict scrutiny standard for explaining the violation of the equal protection.
My purpose in asking the question was not to inflame the issue, but to make the point that if there is no explanation at all, which appears to be the case at least with respect to one of the factors used to deny his parole release, how would one know? How would one know that the defendant, who is black, is now asserting a race claim or an equal protection claim if there's no record?
I don't know, Your Honor, but in this case, we don't have to deal with that because that's not the allegations that are before the court right now. That wasn't a claim presented in the petition.
But Mr. Connor, are you done?
Yes.
Mr. Connor, short of race, one of the static risk factors is gender. So Mr. Anselmo gets 1 point just for being a man.
Sure.
So could the board, under your theory, they apply it and say, hey, we're going to deny him because he's a man, so it's riskier. So that's it. And would that be not reviewable?
Well, Your Honor, gender is subject to a lesser level of scrutiny.
Intermediate
scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. And so then we'd have to ask whether or not the intermediate scrutiny standard is met or not. Again, that's not an issue in this case that we need to decide right now. So unless somebody brings a claim like that to the court, it's not currently before the court. That's a bridge the court can cross if it ever comes to it.
Well, it seems that the argument, though, is they can deny, they can deviate. So it seems as if your theory is it should go to the legislature. Why am I talking to you three? So, I mean, is the theory that courts really should not be involved in this, and this is clearly a legislative prerogative, and if the legislature is fine with it, being informed,
absolutely.
That's it.
And I think that this is not the case to deviate from this court's consistent holding that there is no right to release. Mr. Anselmo was one vote away from being released on parole in this case. He had 3 parole commissioners vote in his favor and 4 vote against him. He was one vote away. And based on that... and all the argument I've made this morning, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment from below and find that the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding, or error in finding that Mr. Anselmo failed to state a cognizable claim for relief.
Chief, if I may follow up with one question.
Sure.
The way the statute's written presently and that the severity of the crime is to be considered, and this is part of NRS 213-120 or 140 that sets up factors to be considered as well. If we were to do anything other than follow those requirements, then we're acting outside the law and creating, essentially creating law that the legislature didn't see fit to create.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think a decision in the petitioner's favor would be contrary to the public policy that the legislature has tried to set out.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you.
Ms. Harris?
Good morning, Your Honors, and I appreciate the ability to take the extra 3 minutes, even though Mr. Lenhart was talkative. May it please the Court, Emily Ellis on behalf of Mr. Anselmo. And because of time constraints, I will briefly address 2 points on rebuttal. The first is that Lawrence applies here despite the difference in the statutory language, and the second is that the South Carolina cases are directly on point and not distinguishable. To the first point. The fact that there is no right to parole in Nevada is not dispositive. When the court in Lawrence discussed the mandatory language of the California statute, it was in regard to the judicial review that was permitted. Here, as explained in our briefs, judicial review is permitted on other grounds. Inmates such as Mr. Anselmo have an expectation of parole eligibility and an expectation that will be properly considered for parole. Now, these are by statute. 131 says the department shall determine when a prisoner is eligible for parole. 140, once that prisoner is eligible, the board shall consider the release of the prisoner. Now, if we look over to the South Carolina case in particular, the Cooper case sets out the statutes that were discussed there. 2421-260 of South Carolina Code says, once eligible, the board shall review the case. Then 640 says the board must carefully consider. These are nearly identical to our statute. And in there, Cooper found that this statutory language provides that right and that due process. And in particular, he held that because the inmate was rendered ineligible for parole due to the procedure employed by the parole board, i.e., exactly what we have here, relying on fixed factors that can never change, no matter how many courses he takes, no matter how much rehabilitation he engages in, it will never change. Then he is deprived of that interest, which then triggers due process requirements of judicial review. So the South Carolina case, in particular Cooper, is right on point. Now it is important to take a pause. What we're asking for is simply for Mr. Anselmo to be properly considered for parole. As Mr. Lenhart said, we're not asking for a super board for the court today to say he is released, send the paperwork, send him home to his family. But here, the board's continued reliance on immutable factors results in Mr. Anselmo essentially being deemed ineligible for parole. He can never be paroled. To take what counsel said as far as a murderer, then why is he even before the board? If he murdered someone, and that factor can never change, yet all the board looks at is that factor to deem him ineligible, or excuse me, to deny him parole, without saying, taking it a step further, that there's a nexus between what he did 45 years ago and today, the current risk today. Now, we see that there's this due process right trigger. May I briefly conclude?
Yes.
Thank you. So in conclusion, Mr. Anselmo respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court's dismissal of Mr. Anselmo's appeal with instructions to the district court to remand the matter to the board to reconsider Mr. Anselmo's parole, properly adhering to the Nevada parole guidelines and the directives in Inmate Lawrence. And if your honors have any questions, if not, I will submit on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I think the lawyers did an outstanding job in arguing the case. I think they deserve some applause, don't you think? I'd like to make a couple of quick observations, if I may, beyond those that were mentioned before we started. First of all, I want to mention that Justice Stiglitz, for you ladies who might be interested in the law, is the sixth woman to be sworn in on the Nevada Supreme Court in our 200-year history almost. I want to also mention the fact that Mr. Lenhart identified the fact that he and his firm were appointed to represent Mr. Anselmo pro bono. To be clear, what that means is he's representing that client for free. So both him as a partner in a well-recognized law firm in our state and Ms. Ellis and their legal assistant, Ms. McKenzie, have all worked on this case for free. This is commendable, and by the way, over 2,800 lawyers in our state handle pro bono cases for free throughout the state of Nevada and have provided in excess of 180,000 hours to people who have civil legal needs and did not have the ability to pay for a lawyer. So, Mr. Lenhart, to you and your firm, thank you. And to get close to home, I thought some of you may not be aware of this. You're a bit younger, but you should be very proud that Mr. Connor is a 1989 graduate of Reed High School. Actually, I think it's 1999, isn't it, Mr. Connor? Sorry. I added 10 years. We were commenting before I came in here, when I was running for the district court in 1998, I spoke to the government class in that year here at Reed High School, and Mr. Connor was a student in that class. Very, very special. His teacher, Jenny Young, is here today. Hi, Jenny. How are you? Ms. Morgan is coming. In the interest of time, I would like to invite you to ask any questions you might have for the lawyers or myself. I will just cover one thing about the case you just heard and the case that you will hear following. When the court hears a case and it is submitted, and for the record, Ms. Clerk, the case will be deemed submitted, the judges will confer in conference. We will discuss the case and the law pretty extensively between and among us, and then vote the case up. Depending upon how that vote takes place, one of the justices will be assigned the responsibility to write the order or opinion that resolves the case. As I mentioned earlier, we're not in a position to talk about this case, but I certainly would welcome any questions for just a few minutes before we hear argument in the next case. Do any of you have any questions for the court or for the lawyers? Yes, sir. Good point. We have read all the briefs in preparation for this, and by the way, the briefs were pretty extensive in this case, probably about 40 pages in the opening and the answering brief, and about 36 pages in the reply brief. We take into account
the briefs and what's been written, the record that has been made. We also take into account what has been argued here today and the answers that we receive. This argument and every argument of the court is recorded by the clerk's office. And by the way, I want to apologize. I should have introduced our court clerk, and she also is very relatively new, having recently been appointed to the as clerk of the court, Ms. Elizabeth Brown. I also want to mention that in the audience today is Rick Stephanie. Rick is the head of the IT department for the Nevada Supreme Court. We're glad to have Rick here. Thank you. We'll take two or three more questions, and then we'll take a brief break, and then we'll come back and hear the next case. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
You're elected, right?
Yes, sir.
This house will come back. Is the fact that you're elected have any influence over your decision in court? Fear that the people that you represent are going to vote someone else in the office. Has that ever been influenced in making your choice as a judge?
Good question. First of all, let me say that the Supreme Court justices are elected statewide. My perspective is I don't represent the people, I represent the law. My job is to decide cases based on the rule of law. And I can tell you that in the 18 years I've had the privilege of serving as a judge, I have never allowed the seriousness of the offense, the issues that were raised, the notoriety of the case to influence my decision. I believe the best judge is the judge who doesn't worry about his or her next election. It's the judge who focuses on the rule of law.
Most of us have been on the trial court bench, as well as the Supreme Court, I completely agree with Justice Hardesty, and I think you'll find most of those that are serving are doing it for the right reason. And there was a study done that tried to link up, this was several years ago, they studied all the Supreme Courts and tried to make a determination whether campaign contributions for the elected judges or political considerations came into the justices' consideration when they were looking at cases, or their party affiliation. And what they found was basically Nevada's schizophrenic, because they couldn't find that anything really affected our decisions. Whether it be ideology or campaign contributions, and I think there was one other state that they found that was essentially the same, and so it's something that that just validates what Jim just said.
I believe there's a question from this young lady back in the back. I'm going to ask Justice Stamets to respond. When you are new to the court, you are given the more difficult questions.
It's called hazing.
No, I just want to give her a chance to respond. By the way, because she may have mentioned to you, she attended Cal Berkeley. She also played softball there. And by the way, I understand Reed High School is headed into the Northern 4A Championships this weekend. Good luck for Reed High.
I think I should have taken the election question. I mean, I think what you've identified, and one thing that's interesting about the law, is the law moves slow. And it does, because these cases that we're talking about, they happened years ago. So it takes a while for the law, for the cases to make their way up and for the law to develop. And in rapidly changing ideologies, the way that the world moves, the law sometimes, it takes a little while for it to catch up. And so your questions about scrutiny and intermediate scrutiny and how we should view those lenses are going to come in the context of cases. And they're going to come in the context of situations where that particular issue is put to the test. When somebody doesn't get a job because of their gender identity, or doesn't get a job because of their sex, those are going to be the questions then the court will have to wrestle with. And looking backward in precedent, because we're grounded in precedent, what has the court done before? What does the Constitution say? And looking forward about what is this society now, and how does this affect people? These are real difficult questions that the court has to wrestle with. And, yeah, just Tarski, please.
And so Oberfeld's decision has sort of opened that door, hasn't it? It has raised the question about whether, in the context of marriage, that we would reevaluate standards in our country from a constitutional basis and begin to set the groundwork for looking at sex as an example or transgender as an example as receiving higher scrutiny review. But as Justice Stiglitz noted, I told you she's smart, but as Justice Stiglitz noted, this process begins, it evolves. I went to McGeorge Law School, University of Pacific. My constitutional law professor was Justice Anthony Kennedy, probably one of the most inspiring academic experiences in my life. And he views the law precisely as Justice Stiglitz just articulated. The law grows on a case-by-case basis and from opinion to opinion. So in your lifetime, you will see that subject raised a number of times, and it will go up and down as to how the courts approach it, depending upon societal norms and acceptability. I will take one last question and we'll take a break. Anybody from over here? How about down here?
Right there.
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do you think that in the past election, both Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton expressed opposition to the ruling of Citizens United? I'd like to ask, as voters and as elected officials, do you agree or disagree with the ruling of Citizens United?
I'd like to ask Mr. Connor and Mr. Leonard and Ms. Ellis to comment on that question. Mr. Connor?
Thank you.
What I was saying is that even though I happen to be a Republican, I'm not really in favor of Citizens United. I think he has a real bad influence in politics, and I think there needs to be a bit more control on the contributory process or the contribution process.
One thing you should understand is that doesn't affect judges. We're very specifically limited as to what we can, the amounts that we can raise from any particular individual, or so it's not like it's wide open for the
judges. I was not aiming those comments at judges. That is very true. And the judges, both in the Supreme Court and on the district court benches, are very careful about how they take any contributions, whether it be from lawyers or private citizens. Contributions are limited, and frankly, the national election process will take a lesson on how the local election process is handled here as far as the limitation of contributions.
Ms. Allison, then just English.
As a good associate, I would agree with Mr. Lenhart.
Justice English?
It's curious that there's an adjective before that. Just saying. But what I want to say is, and to the question in the back we had, and now about elections and money in elections, your legislature is meeting right now. We don't make the laws. They make the laws. And they're dealing with issues of gender, race, sex, money in elections, money for donations. They deal with all those issues here right now. And you have great questions and great insights. And you need to pay attention to what's going on down there, because those are the laws that are going to affect the people that sit on this stage, the people that will govern your lives here in the state of Nevada. The rules, the laws, they're all happening right now. And so the questions you're raising, they're dealing with them. And I'm so impressed that you're bringing them up and that you're thinking about them. And I encourage you to reach out and talk to your legislators and find out what's going on down there.
So to summarize Justice Stiglitz's response, the answer to your questions rests with you. We'll take a 5-minute break, and I mean 5 minutes.